Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. It's nice to be back in the Main Street studio. And my thanks to Eric Dethridge for holding down the fort while I was traveling through the Rocky Mountains. We have a lot to get to today. In the second half of today's show, we'll rethink drought in a changing climate, talk about June berries in July, and hear how tribes are confronting climate-driven displacement. We begin Main Street today by asking this question. If you had nearly $1 billion to invest in healthcare reform, where would you start? Today on this Conversations on Healthcare, co-hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner are joined by Dr. Joseph Betancourt, president of the Commonwealth Fund. It's one of the oldest and most influential healthcare foundations in the country. The fund is focused on expanding access, improving outcomes, and promoting equity regardless of politics or zip code. Dr. Betancourt shares the fund's latest research, including its state-by-state health system scorecard, explains how they're addressing private equity's growing role in healthcare delivery, and he lays out a blueprint for restoring trust in public health. From primary care burnout to vaccine hesitancy and Medicaid reform, this conversation shines a light on a path forward.
Well, Dr. Betancourt, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you having me and look forward to the conversation.
And we are here at Aspen Ideas Health and got to say thank you for the Commonwealth Fund support of this really important conversation that goes on over the next couple of days.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Certainly.
And, you know, we've had the opportunity to have Karen Davis and Dr. Blumenthal on the show. We're really familiar with the Commonwealth Fund. I'm not sure everybody in the country, they should be. And I'm wondering if you might share some of your mission, vision, and values of the fund.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Karen and David are mentors, icons, and friends. So it's an honor to be invited to continue that legacy of representation here at Aspen. So the Commonwealth Fund was established in 1918, and it's important to call out that it was established by a woman, Anna Harkness.
Right.
The Harkness family was lucky enough to be very generous with the resources that they had acquired through investments in Standard Oil and through incredible generosity of Anna Harkness. $10 million was leveraged to start the Commonwealth. Commonwealth Fund in its early days, with its focus on doing well for the common good, funded some incredible work. The first public health departments.
That's right.
First rural hospitals that led to the Hill-Burton Act. The first advanced practice practitioner programs. We've done work in our early days as well on the first palliative care service. Really incredibly innovative work, first medical schools in urban areas. So the list goes on and on. In the last 25 years, it's been a pivot more to health policy. And our mission is affordable, high quality healthcare for everyone.
Yeah.
We're part think tank, part do tank, where we provide grants to advance improving coverage, improving care, addressing healthcare costs, of course, making sure we leave no one behind, so improving equity.
Yeah.
And we have some international learning and exchange that's part of our portfolio of work. So it's an exciting time. Certainly I'm thrilled to be part of such a, I think, well-regarded institution that has provided in a nonpartisan way, but in a very well-respected way, evidence to shape policy. Most recently, some of the evidence that helped lead to the Affordable Care Act. So here we are in another time where we're trying to raise our voice and bring our science to bear in a time where we're facing some pretty challenging decisions around coverage, care, cost, and equity.
Yeah, I know that list is long. I think child guidance I would add to the to the area that you really were a seminal leader in the field.
Yep. Oh yeah, I'm giving it short shrift. I mean, it's more than 100 years of, I think, trying to really make a difference for all Americans.
That's
and
right.
also trying to share and learn from international partners.
Yeah.
I think it's really time that we have that humility to understand that we don't have it all worked out. I think many, many Americans understand that we have a lot to do, and there are ways in which we can learn from other places. And so, you know, that's an important part of our work.
Well, we really appreciate the history that you shared, and we'd like to honor our ancestors and the founding of organizations and know that that legacy lives on. So thank you. And you've just released your scorecard on state health system performance.
Yes.
And this is an important contribution, I think, that the fund makes. We'd love for you to maybe tell us a little bit about the report itself. How long have you been doing it? What's the goal? And of course, what are the findings that you're seeing during this important time?
Yeah, so I've inherited a wonderful team that creates a series of report cards and scorecards that do everything from compare the US to international partners to rank all 50 states on things like quality and outcomes and access, equity scorecards, women's health scorecards. Yep. So really incredible work, and I think important. We have just released our state scorecard, which ranks all 50 states on a series of measures, public data, in three areas, as I mentioned previously, looking at outcomes, looking at access, and looking at quality. And I think what we see is more of the same as it relates to the states that are high performing and low performing. But let me just take a step back and say, big picture. We have really demarcated unprecedented healthcare coverage insurance gains. Unprecedented, right. 93 to 94% of Americans with insurance. We see that in our state scorecard, incredibly important. Despite that, we also see some troubling signs. In fact, we see that vaccination rates have dropped, childhood vaccination rates have dropped in every single state since 2019, and infant mortality has increased in 20 states. So while we have historic coverage gains and people able to get the care they need in much better ways and more than in the past, we also have these troubling signs that I think are even more challenging given some of the decisions that are being made now in Washington. I'll end just by saying that we, year after year, can identify the critical success factors between states that are high performing and low performing. It's investment in coverage. Massachusetts, mm-hmm. routinely number one, has invested in universal coverage. It's greater investment in the social drivers of health. And certainly, I think we're all trying to do more by way of primary care investment. And the states that end up on the lower side clearly demonstrate that not only federal policy matters, but state policy matters. Right. That's why we see those differences.
And there's some nuance in that. You have a Mississippi, which might be low, but scores well on investment in primary care, right? I mean, it's a nuanced report, which I find interesting. Maybe just pulling the thread on the immunization side, there are seven, I guess, recommended doses for children. 75% of the country or the states have them all. But you were trying to pull the thread on why. What's the reason? It wasn't all about misinformation, was it?
Yeah.
What were some of the other factors?
Well, I mean, I think misinformation certainly plays a role. There's no doubt that the pandemic and everything that transpired around COVID vaccinations and mandates and closing schools and that entire, I think, set of situations that we faced, it did. It did create likely greater hesitancy among people, asking more questions. I think that we also understand that during that time, also in addition to the concerns that people had, there was some misinformation that was mm-hmm. put forth. Mm-hmm. Accessibility and availability, I think, become an issue as well. But at the end of the day, when we think about the biggest and most impactful public health interventions of our history, vaccinations is top three, along
Absolutely.
With sanitation and
right.
antibiotics.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we are in favor, again, of providing evidence and science. And certainly I, as a primary care doctor, want to make sure that the vaccines that I'm recommending to my patients are safe.
Of course.
So, you know, having that discernment is something that we welcome. By the same token, many, many, many of these vaccines have been tested over and over again and have been shown to save lives, and some estimates, 500 million lives across the globe.
That's
right. So this is an important time for us to really bring that science forward.
I'm glad you mentioned sewage. My dad was a water chemist, always reminded me that the big changes in life expectancy happened with the onset of indoor plumbing.
Of course, we're from the state that put fluoride in the water for the first time, too. So
you know, that's,
we could talk a lot about water.
Critically important. I mean, I think I'm doing a panel tomorrow on reimagining public health. Public health doesn't, I mean, as
right.
the people on the ground, they don't understand the incredible public health interventions that are happening around them that they don't see, hear, and feel because we don't constantly tout that.
Yeah.
Sanitation is a basic one. We take a lot of things for granted. Clean water, I mean, the list goes on, but major public health interventions.
Well, let me ask an unfair question because you're just going through your first change of administration, but over the time, the Commonwealth has always dealt with administrations that come in and make changes.
Yep.
And that just happens. That's the nature of the reality. What do you do internally in terms of your planning process? Because you probably have a game plan that arches over all of these, but at the same time, there are some tactical decisions to make. Certainly, you're a leader in the field. How are you thinking about?
Yep, no doubt. It's preparation. Mm-hmm. We began, you know, well before the election, you know, deep into, you know, I'd say early, shall I say, but many, many, many months ago into 2024. Engaging, because it's nonpartisan, our goal is engagement. Engaging individuals who are going to be involved in either administration with the notion that engagement is something we want. We did want to get perspectives about what the different ideas were around health policy on both sides. and really having a game plan for both sides and how they might bring forward health policy. Yep. And so that preparation really helped us. We understood that things like work requirements and Medicaid were absolutely coming. We understood that on the bright side, there was an interest in primary care right. and an interest in prevention. Right. So that preparation really helped us. And we have built trusting relationships with individuals who have connections and are, in many cases, part of the administration sure. and want to add value to their decisions. Sure. So I think that's...
Find that seam of commonality.
That's right.
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah, I mean, our goal is improving the health of the American people, yeah. agnostic to which political party is doing it, yep. but steadfast in our mission and vision and values to provide that evidence that's needed to make sure that we are committed to the health right. of all American people. Mm-hmm.
And part of that mission, vision, and values is you need data.
Yep.
And you note that in the scorecard that there's some threats to public data, and that data is part of what helps us to look at health system performance. And while I could take an educated guess at what kind of data might be missing or difficult to obtain, we'd like to hear it from you.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of big data sets, particularly out of the CDC, you know, series of data sets that really provide key information on public health, on health outcomes, on hospital outcomes, and a big one on health equity. You know, certainly we understand, and our commitment at the Commonwealth Fund is to make sure everyone, no matter who they are, where they're from, how much money they make, gets the best we have to offer, and we leave no one behind. Sadly, what we've seen is a lot of the data that's been stripped away prevents us from really being able to assess the national landscape, find out where the gaps are, and think about where interventions might be. Right. So this is a major challenge, and we're working with partners like Academy Health mm-hmm. to figure out, is there opportunities to stand up data sets, lift up data sets, try to advocate for the preservation of data sets. But you know, we cannot navigate without information.
That's right.
And so clearly data is important, and we lament any efforts to pull data back that prevents us from monitoring the health of the American people.
I think we've seen the same thing in the community health center system, 30 million patients, the uniform data set report, which had ample data on all the characteristics that you're speaking of being pulled back for a while. We're hoping that comes back because that's very important data for you as well, given the focus of the patient population.
Yeah, and it's data, and that data needs to be taken care of by people, right? So the reduction in forces as well in HHS are concerning. So there's a lot of things that are concerning around our ability to, again, to monitor and improve the health of the American people. But the data one is certainly one that's really critical to us as we think we play an important role there.
And it's so important to underscore, you're looking at everyone in the country.
No doubt.
There's no red states, no blue states, every state.
No doubt.
Is what you're looking at. And talk a little bit about the blueprint for health equity. And when was it published? And what do you think the timeline will be for implementation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we began to talk about this notion that really health equity, and it's evolved. I'll just say it's evolved because sadly, what we see is there's been a weaponization of even the simple term health equity
right.
and a co-opting of that narrative. I spent my career doing work on health equity in red and blue states. And ultimately, what I've been able to do as I engage with people in of all different political persuasions is to say that we collectively care about doing exactly what I mentioned previously, making sure that any individual who enters our hospital, no matter who they are, where they're from, gets evidence-based clinical guidelines and the best care. This notion of an equity blueprint is one that simply says we need to, number one, have good data to identify where gaps are. Number two, we need to take action to fill those gaps and monitor our progress. Strategic planning, measurement, continued quality improvement intervention is essential. And we never for once said this is just about black people or brown people or those people or those people. It's about all people, and that's the fabric of our nation. So this blueprint, I think, is as we evolve it now, we're trying to be more precise with what we mean when we talk about health equity. We think that's really, really critical and give examples of differences or disparities that impact people in rural settings, right. that impact women, people with disabilities, people who have low socioeconomic status, just to kind of, reclaim that narrative and provide that precision and clarity.
Well, I want to pick up on the regional thought because it's been clear in the last couple of months as we've had the conversation about Medicaid. There have been nice reports about every congressional district and the level of Medicaid recipients in them. And you can see it knows no boundaries,
yes.
right? And I think it's getting back to this issue of lies, damn lies, and statistics. We want the data to really unite us, not to divide us.
That's right. I mean, it's paradoxical in many cases. I mean, some of the, you know, some regions that are the reddest, you know, in many cases have the most Medicaid recipients.
That's right.
And so this doesn't just track by blue or red, and we want the best for all. So ultimately, I think we're trying to provide the evidence around if and how you change Medicaid. You know, these are the impacts: economic impact on rural hospitals, impact on all people, not just those with Medicaid, impact on the economy, impact on jobs. We feel that's our responsibility. So whether you're trying to make enrollment or re-enrollment harder, whether you're trying to leverage work requirements, whether you're trying to cut back on certain payments in the name of fraud, waste, and abuse, we have no problem with addressing fraud, waste, and abuse, but we do need to be very clear about the impact of some of these changes and the potential loss of insurance of 14 to 16 million Americans.
It's a huge, huge number. Are you working with the National Governors Association? How do you sort of orchestrate, if you don't mind us getting the inside the Beltway view of who you're working with, who are your strategic partners?
Absolutely. So, you know, we just recently, within the last couple of weeks, had a visit to Washington, D.C. We have a great partnership with NAASHPE, the National Academy of State Health Policymakers, where we brought with NAASHPE in partnership and with the Milbank Foundation as well, Milbank Fund, about 30 leaders of health and human services from across the country. And brought them to D.C. We meet, we strategize, we have discussions. And when I say strategize, just sharing, really, in that convening. But we had a chance to spend an hour with Dr. Oz over at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Very, very productive conversation. Clearly, I think we were able to, the state directors, in fact, were able to provide their perspectives on what some of these changes would mean for them operationally, from an execution standpoint, from a cost standpoint. I think Dr. Oz really listened. It was clear. He said, you know, we are not trying to create barriers to kick people off Medicaid. We're trying to make sure that Medicaid dollars go to those who are most vulnerable. Fair. He talked about work requirements and things like it's not just work. It could be community volunteer.
That's right.
So, you know, we had a really great dialogue. And I think dialogue is what we want. And these types of engagements allow us to find common ground. He had a lot of learnings from that group who said, you know, how are we going to, these data sets, eligibility for SNAP is different than for Medicaid. Right. Doing this enrollment, I mean, this is a big thing. It's not just flip a switch on work requirements or the like. Great conversation. That's the
And they're going to have to implement it.
No doubt.
CMS is going to.
Could be millions of dollars, incredible additional red tape. So, you know, at a time where you're trying to, you know, kind of limit bureaucracy, you could add a whole lot more.
Right.
Good exchange, and that's what we aim to foster.
Margaret, we just had a great conversation with Stephanie Carlson, the deputy administrator, who really talked about exactly what Dr. Betancourt was saying about this. We want to work together, particularly on the work requirements.
And you've been a champion of primary care for your whole career. I know you trained as an internist, right?
But still practice.
Good. Champion of primary care. And you've made it clear you think there's reforms that we need in payment and there's investments that we need to make. You also referenced the Milbank Fund, who I've worked with on their work on primary care shortage. I'm sure you've seen the report, Nobody Will See You Now,
right?
The play on the old, the doctor will see you now. What are your top strategies for addressing the primary care crisis that's evolving, even in the presence of people having insurance, not having access to a primary care service?
So I'm a practicing primary care doctor still. I see patients for a half day a week at practice for almost 25 years. I'd say a couple of things. We are in the midst of a very significant primary care crisis. If we just disentangle a couple of pieces from a workforce standpoint, we know that we lost 10% of the primary care workforce from 2005 to 2015, even before the pandemic. 21 to 22, we lost another 16,000 primary care doctors. Average age of a primary care doctor is now 60 years old. We have a really very, very significant administrative burden on our primary care doctors, and I would argue demoralization. The simple notion that I want to do the most and best for my patient, and I can't because people are getting in the way, and this is incredibly demoralizing. You line that up with the fact that there are no reinforcements coming behind us. Medical students are not choosing primary care for all these reasons.
Right. We see the graph.
Yeah, not to mention
dermatology.
Loan and debt. And so we have a challenge here. Now, we at the Commonwealth Fund have had a program on primary care that's really talked about pushing value-based payment, supporting the community health centers, doing those types of things. We're going to redouble that effort now with the launching of our new strategic plan in September. We're going to focus on primary care and rural health, where primary care issues are even more challenging.
Right.
But I think we've reached a tipping point. You know, Americans across the country are having incredible difficulty accessing primary care.
Yeah.
And providers are as frustrated as patients. So we have a unique opportunity, I think, to leverage that frustration to some action. Now, sadly, when I go to the Hill, what we hear from many leaders on the Hill is we don't hear from primary care doctors enough. Specialists show up here and talk to us a lot about payment and all those things.
The primary care providers are too busy seeing patients.
Yeah, they don't, right? So we're not hearing from them. Squeaky wheel does get the grease. So, you know, I think Also, in addition to value-based payment, we're thinking about ways in which we can amplify what the workforce might be. Earlier session today, talking about community health workers, navigators, healthcare coaches, of course, nurse practitioners, advanced practice practitioners. We have international models that demonstrate when you put all those people in a team, particularly in a value-based setting, you know, you get great results. And so how do we drive towards that? But I would argue, as a practicing clinician, it's not just about payment. I think my peers, you know, paying them a little more is not going to get the
satisfaction.
Job. They need system change.
Yeah.
They want to be able to find meaning in the care they provide and be able to provide care to their patients at a level that's high quality. And so we're trying to level that all in and also really think about technology. We're very bullish on the impact of technology and how it could help us.
Well, you've made so many great points there. I just want to pick up on a couple of them. One, nurse practitioners and physician assistants. Margaret set up the first nurse practitioner residency program 16 years ago, so we're invested in that.
Commonwealth was a big supporter.
Very good.
There are now 500 of them across the country and growing, and that's an important one. But, you know, it's the loan issues that are looming large, and one of the provisions in the new bill is to cap medical school education at $125,000, which may be 1 or 2 years. But not 4 years. And we understand they're trying to get costs more affordable because we want to attract a diverse group of population into this field. Yeah. What are your thoughts in terms of the financing that's going to be needed? I'd say that, and also the scholarship, you know, the money to keep people in the field in terms of special populations, making sure they're working for those who are interested, have the financial support for working in underserved communities.
Loan and debt are very, very significant. We do know that it is critical to train people in community settings and provide them the incentives, because at the end of the day, if you have big loans and debt, that's going to force your hand.
Yeah.
I mean,
where
it's about survival, where you practice, the practice you choose, who you choose to care for. And many people say, I'd love to do X, but I just can't. And we don't want it. Number one, we need people taking care of individuals in rural settings and vulnerable populations. And number two, it's a shame if we have people who want to do it and can't do it because of these extenuating factors. This is going to require a significant transformation. And I think tied to this is how medical education will need to dramatically change as well with technology. I mean, we have to acknowledge that in the next 3 to 5 years, 7 years, in my view, care will be drastically different. I think we will see a reimagining of what primary care looks like, where we have chunks of, I believe, things that primary care doctors do now taken off their plates, done, managed in a team-based way, very, very effectively, at a very high and I think level of excellence. But the medical training, we need to adapt to that. And like all things healthcare, we have a lot of deeply entrenched systems, I think, that are resistant to these changes. And you know, these changes are going to happen whether the systems acquiesce or not. But I think the training and the debt and how this plays out is going to be really critical going forward.
Yeah. You know, philanthropy is so important. And I asked you earlier about what you're doing with Governors Association or other groups. Wondering about other foundations across the country, how you're working with them, and some of these small ones, and how are you working to cultivate philanthropy?
Yep.
We need this next generation, and primary care is where we hope they invest, but we also hope they get engaged somewhere where they're interested. What are you doing to sort of tie together with the philanthropy community and also trying to think about cultivating a different culture for giving?
Yeah, so I've been in this role, again, a little bit less than 3 years. I'm a big believer in collaboration. We have big problems. I can't solve it with $25 million in grant making. And I don't have pride of ownership either. I think at the end of the day, we have had examples of very strong collaboratives. We were part of something called the 7F, which is high need, high cost, older Americans. That began just as that was phasing out. We now have a collaborative of over 10 foundations who are working on primary care. We need this. And quite frankly, I think these crises create opportunity for greater collaboration.
Yeah.
We as foundations have also come together in the defense of our resources, as we've had in the bills of potential increase
some of the
in taxes. Our
tax.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, I think that's created greater connectivity between the foundations. And I think it's connected some foundations that are right, left, and center. You know, when I say right, left, and center, I mean leaning. Of course, many of them are nonpartisan, but of course,
University of Texas and Harvard are going to be treated the same way.
Yeah.
And they may have different political stripes.
Ultimately, there's opportunities for leveraging philanthropy. We're never going to fill some of the gaps like the NIH cuts.
Right.
But can we leverage our convening power to really think about what is the right path forward? Not just stop that. Don't do that. Let's not do that.
Right.
Because I think we have to acknowledge it wasn't perfect.
Right.
Clearly, there's a lot of disruption and I'd say some destruction in what's happening right now. But what we really need is a plan forward quickly. And that's what I think philanthropy could help catalyze that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure that we always see where we're going as we're going. And I think one of the phenomena of the last several years that kind of came to roost, we saw it in Massachusetts, we saw it in Connecticut, we've seen it in other states, is the role of private equity in healthcare, both at the hospital and tertiary level, but also at the primary care level.
Yeah.
We think over here about some of the pressure that primary care teams are feeling, and that private equity role seems to be exerting influence there as well. Yeah. Does the fund have a position on that? Have you done
Absolutely.
Any studies or looked at the impact specifically of that? And we could describe it, but I think everybody knows what we mean.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, we have done work on, again, the science behind private equity with a particular interest in when private equity engages in healthcare delivery, what is the impact on cost, quality, and safety? And we've done work in that space, published in that space. We are launching as part of our strategic plan under our cost pillar, an area that's focusing on what have been called the commercial drivers of health.
Uh-huh.
And the simple notion that many people are feeling that there's a tension between profit and patients mm-hmm. that has been played out probably in its worst case with the national story of Steward Healthcare,
right.
where really you have wealth extraction at the expense of health creation.
Yeah.
And again, we want the evidence to take us to the rightful conclusion, but the evidence to date, not all private equity investments are the same, not all private equity investors are the same, but we do believe that we want to make sure that people are acting with the American people's health and well-being in mind, and there's accountability for that. It's not about over-regulating, but it is about making sure that we don't see Steward healthcare type situations again, where hospitals close, communities are left without
right.
clinicians, and an incredible amount of wealth has been extracted out of those
right.
hospitals. And so it's complex, but we're there and we're gonna stay there.
One of the most pressing problems of our day. It was mentioned in the Commonwealth announcement of your to the presidency that you are of Latino descent.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could share with us that exciting news and what does it mean for you?
Yeah, you know, this is a great opportunity. I mean, I think for me, my lived experience informs a lot of my ideas around how our foundation can go forward. And it's lived experience that really is about respect. It's about making sure, again, that we leave no one behind. It is about making sure that I and we do the best for everyone. Those are the values that I bring personally. Those are the values that I bring as a clinician. And those are the values that are very well aligned with the Commonwealth Fund. So it's an honor and a privilege to bring my set of kind of cultural, professional, personal values and experiences to a place that has that alignment and try to think about just making us more impactful. It is, you know, working at the fund and getting a chance to lead the fund, it's what I call a beautiful puzzle. The pieces are all there. How do we put the puzzle better, put it together in a way that's even better than it was before?
Yeah.
I think all those things inform how we think about it. And we have a fantastic team who's aligned as well.
You know, I have to ask you, I followed your work. I think we probably both did because we were doing the same thing in Connecticut during COVID-19.
Yes.
And you took on a very strong leadership role in community health. What are the enduring lessons that you learned from that?
It was incredible. I mean, I'd say a couple things just related to that. When we think about care, and the pandemic really shone a light on this, we need to think about doorstep to bedside and back. Our inability to prevent the spread of COVID in essential workers, people taking public transportation, people in generational housing, not kind of doing work in that space led to that incredible imbalance at the bedside. And so bringing that holistic view is really important. And I think that's one of the key lessons. I think another really important key lesson that we learned during the pandemic is, man, when stuff's on fire, how quickly people will move. The amount of red tape.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
And this
innovation.
Innovation and this universal focus on every minute is a life. We used to laugh during the pandemic and we'd say, you remember the days where you and I would say, okay, yeah, let's set up a phone call in a week. No, let's set up a phone call in 1 hour.
On Sunday.
With 100 people.
With 100 people, because every minute matters. And I think I do want to tie that to the demoralization piece. Because the pandemic for many caregivers was the worst of times for all the reasons we know, but it was the best of times because all this stuff was out of the way.
That's exactly
and then when you
right.
come back out of that, adrenaline infused exhaustion, but exhilaration that, you know, along the way you save some lives and now you have to deal with prior approvals, it's really tough.
Yeah.
And so Can we get that secret sauce again? Can we deploy that type of energy around behavioral health?
Yeah.
Another pandemic.
Yeah.
Maternal health.
Yeah.
Another pandemic.
Yeah.
So that those are the big lessons for me.
Great. Perfect.
Well, Dr. Betancourt, thank you for sharing a light on the work that Commonwealth Fund is doing and for the leadership that you're providing.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Joseph Betancourt, president of the Commonwealth Fund, joining co-hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner on Conversations on Healthcare from Aspen Ideas Health. Whether it's improving primary care, safeguarding public health data, or fostering bipartisan solutions, his message was clear. Healthcare must work for everyone. You can learn more about the fund's work and explore their latest scorecards at commonwealthfund.org. Still to come on Main Street, a prairie tradition, June berries in July, and rethinking drought in a changing climate, plus staying or leaving. Tribes confront climate-driven displacement. That's all ahead right here on Main Street. Stay with us. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. We're glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. It's the season of guarded secrets and bird-proof netting. In this Plainsfolk essay, historian and forager Dr. Tom Ezern reflects on the humble Juneberry, also known as Saskatoon, ripening just in time for early July. Well, while Canada may boast plantations, here in North Dakota, Juneberries remain a treasured part of prairie folklore and kitchen tradition. From purple polka-dotted pancakes to Mennonite pastries, Dr. Ezern shares the harvest of memory and meaning.
There are hundreds of commercial Saskatoon plantations in the prairie provinces of Canada. Here we have few, although the Nowatzki pick-your-own operation near Langdon has been going for a couple of decades. Perhaps this is a neglected commercial opportunity, but I am personally sort of happy that our Juneberries in North Dakota remain largely in the realm of folklife. People have their favorite picking places and guard their secrets, although they are no secret to the birds. Three species descend on our patch: cedar waxwings, who perch and eat on the top branches, brown thrashers, who come up from the ground, and robins, who occupy the mid-height of the bushes. Left unchecked, they will strip the branches bare before the berries are even ripe. Thus, we enclose our Juneberries with nylon nets, which poses another problem as the birds look for any hole or gap whereby they might gain admittance, but of course cannot find their way back out again. So we inspect the nets and peg the edges to the ground in the interest of avian safety. We can hardly consume our crop in season, which is good because we want Juneberries year-round. The best method of preservation is flash freezing. Then you can pack the frozen berries in bags and shake out what you need. We commonly flash freeze a couple dozen quarts. We don't use Juneberries for jelly. We have lots of other good fruits for jellies, preserves. The highest and best use remains pie, especially in a household such as ours, which boasts a champion pie maker. Our contribution to culinary culture in this respect is what we call a goonberry pie, Juneberries mixed with Pixwell gooseberries. Juneberries, for my taste, need something tart mixed with them. The same combo is great in turnovers, including the German-Russian iteration of turnover, Plachinda, and the buttery Mennonite version, my favorite, Hemmenschwanger. While we're in German-Russian country, we can note that Juneberries are a fine addition to Kuchen filling, or, irrespective of Kuchen, I'd like to just bake them into a custard topped with a little brown sugar. We hardly ever eat sourdough pancakes without Juneberries in them. I love those purple polka dots on the griddle. I don't know anyone making pemmican with Juneberries anymore, but among indigenous folk, they are stewed into a sauce, that's wojapi in Dakota, into which fry bread is dredged. Juneberries are essential for my favorite winter salad, spinach greens with red onion, topped with Juneberries and blue cheese. Here is where the flash freezing technique shows its worth, as you can just shake the berries from the bag. Finally, muffins. We don't care for cakey muffins, so ours have a mix of flours in them, including a bit of whole wheat, but Juneberries are ideal for muffins. Instead of disintegrating and bleeding into the baking muffins, they plump up to constitute purple vanilla balms in every bite. Moreover, studies at Cornell University confirm the nutritional superiority of Juneberries over their wimpy competitor, blueberries. When will they be ripe this year? Hard telling. Close study of historic reports indicates Juneberries, in line with warming conditions, are maturing earlier these days.
That was Plainsfolk, a weekly essay from our dear friend and historian, Dr. Tom Easern from North Dakota State University, where he is a distinguished professor of history. He reflects on life and landscape across the Great Plains. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. What is drought? And is it still the same as it used to be? As climate change shifts our weather norms, the National Academies of Sciences is developing a new framework to help climatologists and policymakers rethink what dry really means. From leather-bound ledgers to satellite data, Missouri's state climatologists and others across the country are navigating a landscape where the past may no longer be a reliable guide. From the Ag and Water Desk at Harvest Public Media, here's Harshan Ratanpal with more.
Missouri state climatologist Zach Leeser works in an office divided by time. On the right is the old way of doing things. Dozens of scratched and torn leather-bound books filled with more than 100 years of handwritten state and local climate data. Cracking one open, Leeser turns to July 15, 1936, when the city of Columbia saw a high of 111 degrees.
This was the second hottest day on record ever in Columbia at that time in 1936.
A climatologist in the early 1900s would have spent each day collecting data with weather instruments and recording them in these books. But today, Leeser spends much more time on the left side of his office, where his computer is displaying weather models. One of his primary jobs is interpreting vast amounts of data every week to determine which parts of the state are in drought.
It can be precipitation data. We add soil moisture data. We have stream flow that's analyzed, some satellite data as well.
The job of a climatologist has changed a lot in 100 years. The climate has too. And those changes are making it harder to tell what is or isn't a drought. That's because drought is a measure of dryness relative to a, quote, normal baseline. But what if climate change is changing what's considered normal?
Is it really a drought, or is this just the new climate of this region?
That's climatologist Joel Lisenby. He does drought research out of the University of Colorado Boulder and is trying to answer that question. And he says it's a bit situational. There's no one answer to what drought even is. A 1985 study found over 150 published definitions of the term.
You really need to understand what type of drought you're looking at and why you're asking that question in the first place.
For instance, a climatologist whose job it is to take the long view of weather and climate might look at how dry things were over 100 years ago to determine if a place is in drought. If conditions are consistently getting hotter and drier, as they are in the American Southwest, maybe drought isn't the best way to define it. Here's Leeser.
Now, is this drought, or what we call aridification, which is the entire climate getting drier?
That might mean cities develop land and water use plans that account for those changes. But a farmer will define drought more immediately. If things are dry and crops aren't growing, it's a drought. Climatologists are now coming together to figure out how to characterize drought because their proclamations have real practical consequences. For example, one of the tools used to assess drought is the U.S. Drought Monitor. It's updated weekly to track dry conditions and their severity across the country. Some federal policies that give farmers emergency relief money are tied to the Drought Monitor. If it's not calibrated to the new normals caused by climate change, that money might not be going to the right places. Here's Lisenby again.
We're talking real dollars, taxpayer dollars, and we really want to make sure that we're getting that assessment correct.
Understanding new weather and drought patterns is also important for planning ahead.
Building a reservoir or a pipeline or locks along a river, are you going to have enough water during the dry years? If that normal is lowering, is the drought period also lowering with it? These are some unknowns.
Back in his office, Leeser puts the 1936 climate record back on the shelf. He says Missouri doesn't really get to those scorching temperatures anymore. But the state is prone to drought, and its average temperature is trending upward. He'll be watching the National Academy study for how to incorporate that into his drought assessments. I'm Harshan Ratanpal.
That was Harvest Public Media's Harshan Ratanpal reporting on efforts to update how we define and respond to drought in an era of shifting climate baselines. For farmers, scientists, and policymakers alike, the question isn't just how dry is it, but whether our definitions are keeping up with the times.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As the climate crisis worsens, the very ground on which some indigenous communities built their homes is shifting before their eyes. New Orleans Public Radio's Eva Tesfai looked at how tribes in Alaska and Louisiana are losing their land to climate change, forcing them to make tough decisions about whether to stay or to leave. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to her about the story.
Can you talk about why you and Sage Smiley decided to focus on Nunavichuk in Alaska and Point Ocean in Louisiana?
We had already noticed a lot of similarities generally about how climate change is impacting Louisiana and Alaska. And we also noticed that relocation is something that the tribes in both places were thinking about. And so part one of the episode is reported by Sage Smiley. She's the news director of KUYK up in Bethel, Alaska. And she went to this small Native Alaskan village of Nunavichuk, and they plan on relocating because this village is built on permafrost. But because of climate change and warming temperatures, that permafrost is melting, which is causing damage to the houses and the town's infrastructure. Sage talked to Gertrude Lewis. She was a tribal member there.
My grandson, he stepped off the boardwalk and he went knee deep. We had to pull him out. We lost his rubber boot.
When you were a kid, could you play on the tundra?
Everywhere. Everywhere. We went everywhere.
And now you have to stay on the boardwalk.
Stay on the boardwalk.
I, on the other hand, chose to focus on Point Ocean in coastal Louisiana. They're also losing their land due to sea level rise and coastal erosion. And I knew that Point Ocean was right next to another tribal community, Ile de Jean Charles, that actually ended up relocating due to sea level rise. But Point Ocean was adamantly saying, like, we're not even considering moving. It's really important for people to hear from communities like Point Ocean to understand why people who live in these precarious places that are getting even more precarious because of climate change, like, why those people want to stay where they are.
What is Point Ocean like, and what about the place do you think makes people want to stay there?
It's really this like beautiful like coastal like wetland community. When I first got there and I pulled up to the marina with Cherie Mathern, we saw dolphins like immediately, like they were just right there. And it's really just a beautiful place. You can hear about it from Cherie Mathern herself. She's the tribe's cultural heritage and resiliency coordinator.
My husband is a craft fisherman, so he has caught sharks in his cage. He has caught stingrays, turtles, but yeah, so we have just this very diverse ecosystem.
Fishing is really important to people in Point Ocean. For many of them, it's not only their jobs, but it's this way of living that's been passed down from generation to generation. And basically, the area is just home, and they don't want to lose their connection to it.
What are some of the unique challenges facing indigenous people in Louisiana?
I think what's interesting about Louisiana is we have quite a few small tribes along the coast, and so the issues they're facing have a lot to do with intensifying hurricanes. And a lot of those tribes, those small tribes along the coast, don't have federal recognition. It's really hard for them to get all those resources that other towns and communities benefit from the federal government and from FEMA for relocation or adapting in place.
Are these communities and others in similar positions getting help from federal and state governments?
In 2020, the Government Accountability Office released a report, and they basically found it's really difficult for any community to use federal programs for relocation because none of them actually address climate migration specific. And there isn't any one federal agency that is specifically tasked with helping communities relocate. And we need that because relocation projects are really expensive. In terms of money for adapting in place, like what Point Ocean was doing, we used to have this program from FEMA called the Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities Program. But the Trump administration canceled it earlier this year.
What did you learn by reporting this story with another reporter from Alaska?
Reporting the story with Sage, for me, kind of revealed these connections between tribes in Louisiana and Alaska, but also that there are like huge differences. And it also made me realize relocation and adapting in place, those aren't always super different. Like Nunupachuk had to get grants to improve the infrastructure where they are, kind of like adapting in place in a way, because they're not able to move people yet. And then in Point Ocean, a lot of people are also slowly migrating, even though they're, you know, they've decided to adapt in place. So what was hopeful about the whole thing was seeing both Nunupachuk and Point Ocean being so focused on keeping their cultures and their communities together, no matter what decision they make.
That was Eva Tesfai, Coastal Desk reporter for WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. To listen to the full episode, look up Sea Change wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanek Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 22nd. By the early 1900s, amateur mechanics in North Dakota were building their own motor cars and whizzing down dirt roads at the mind-boggling speed of 8 miles per hour. The other rage of the time was aviation. North Dakotans were in on that, too. In 1910, Archie Hoxie created a sensation with the first successful North Dakota flight at Grand Forks. And there was Frances Klingensmith, the first woman in the state to get a pilot's license. She gained national fame as a stunt pilot and a racer. Even more famous, Carl Ben Ileson is known for flying over the Arctic ice caps. On this date in 1909, R. N. Metcalf, a farmer from Driscoll, revealed his plans for a fabulous flying machine. It was a combination of a land vehicle and an airplane and could even serve as a boat. Equipped with 8 propellers, the plane was designed to carry 10 passengers or the equivalent weight in freight. Metcalf said that within 10 days, his prototype, designed to carry 2 people, would be ready to fly. Metcalf had been fascinated with flight since he was a boy. In 1908, he seriously began to explore plans to get an airplane into the skies. In 1909, he announced his plans. That October, he showed the plans to the Fargo Forum and Daily Republican. The newspaper thought it looked like a complicated mass of sails, propellers, and connecting rods. Metcalf asserted that it was not as complicated as it looked. The boat portion was lightweight canvas with a gasoline engine. That part of the machine would carry the passengers. 4 wheels allowed it to be driven on the ground like an automobile. When on the ground, the sails folded like the wings of a bird. Metcalf said that while the machine might need some tinkering, he was confident he was on the right track. Unfortunately, Metcalf's plans never got off the ground, and there is no further mention of his fabulous flying machine in the public record. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, when a bill threatened to move public notices off the pages of North Dakota newspapers, Cecile Warman of the North Dakota Newspaper Association stepped up to defend rural journalism and found a compromise. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us then.